Good morning. It is March 6th, Sunday, Rosh Chodesh Adar Aleph, 2011. Today, we're going to, continue along, chronologically. I found this book, Exclusion in Hierarchy by Adam Furtziger, to be incredibly useful. The citation's in the source sheets, so you don't need to jot it down. And I wanted to, I figured since last week we did bits and pieces of one of the sources that he quoted, I thought it would be a little bit easier to just do more of the direct citations in the English from him, partially because I didn't have access to some of the sources and partially because we do a lot of the readings in English anyway. And I put in citations to the book if anyone wants to check up and try to see the sources in the original if your Hebrew's, if your Hebrew's up for it. Today he, or at least in the next chapter, right before we get to the Chasam Sofer, he describes a distinction between two individuals in particular, one called the Noda Yehuda and the other is Rabbi Yaakov Emden. And the way Furtziger tries to set up the their opposition to excluding certain groups of Jews was in a marked contrast to individuals who weren't keeping mitzvot. How, on an individual level, both of these rabbis seem to be a little more tolerant, but on an institutional level, they became very exclusionary. And I think that's a very important point to consider in line with some of the things that we've been discussing. I put in here some very brief biographies of some important people, for the sake of today. Just briefly copied and pasted a bit from Wikipedia. There's obviously a great deal more that can be said on these individuals. Some of them are in the bibliography here. You've got dissertations and books written about these individuals. One is the Noda Yehuda, Yechezkel ben Yehuda Landau, an influential authority in Halacha, best known Noda Yehuda, title by which he is known. Born in Poland, lived 1713 to 1793. Which should give you a certain time frame of where he lived. Next we have Rav Yaakov Emden, who lived from 1697 until 1776.
Right? Where's Altun?
Where Altun is. Oh, that's bad. I should know that. Yeah, sorry. We're in an area where...
Maybe you should contest the country and the nation that is...
Yes, I apologize for that, my bad. So looking up quickly, it's a city and seaport in the northwest of Germany, on the river Mountains. Name city of the region, there you go. Wow, was embarrassing. Deserved to get caught on that. Thank you very much for calling me on that.
Yeah, it was impressive the way you scrounged up the information in 2 seconds.
Yeah, God bless the internet for that. That wasn't me trying to look back into my head. That was just me drawing a complete and total blank for something I ought to have known. I must care hayom. Anyway, moving on a bit. And, to describe the way Furtziger sets this up here, he says, when it came to both Sabbateanism and the enlightened Jews, both the more moderate Musculum and the radical rationalist philosophers, Landau and Emden, each adopted approaches greatly that differ greatly from the inclusive traditional approaches that were just described. And he explains, it is easy to understand the reasons for both men's basic opposition to the Sabbatean movement, which was grounded in heretical beliefs and led to defections from Judaism nearly a century earlier. In contrast, Landau and Emden did not oppose all aspects of emerging modern world, but even showed a personal interest in secular learning. When it came to the Haskalah movement and the philosophers, however, their approaches were more similar to their attitude towards Sabbateanism than to the way they had generally dealt with religious deviance. That is an important point in its own, or at least the way that Furtziger is trying to set up the equation here, where they were, against Sabbateans, which the fact that they would have been against Sabbateans means you still had some residual Sabbateanism, if not, explicitly then certain holdovers from Sabbatean thought that were floating around. Mm-hmm. And even though on an individual level, if someone, wasn't observant, they might have been a little bit more on the lenient side, they were not going to use the same harsh rhetoric that you would have found elsewhere. As Ed pointed out, very soon, he was the son of the Chacham Tzvi, whom we learned last week, the difference between the Sephardi and the Ashkenazi Shul. And if you remember, with the Sephardi and the Ashkenazi shul, or the Spanish Portuguese and the Ashkenazi shul, which he said was from London, the opposition wasn't that the shul ought to not be included in Judaism. It was people that aren't keeping Jewish law, so if you want to leave and go someplace else, you're fine. It's an important distinction to make between an individual not being observant and a movement. Any thoughts as to what that distinction would be?
I would be politically motivated to knock a movement. To put an individual, yeah, you could talk to him, maybe he can bend him a little bit.
Yeah.
That's pretty much.
A movement to keep recruiting, and staff your members.
Right. So, two sides here. You've got one from a very practical perspective. If you have an individual who's not keeping Torah mitzvot, you can sit down with a guy, talk to him, maybe badger him enough, and you can convince him. But it's also, as you know, Dan put it, it's a risk of one. One person who does something wrong, you can say is an outlier. But a movement can attract more people. When you attract more people, right, then you have a greater risk of bleeding off from the establishment than if one person is just doing his own thing. You can ostracize an individual without losing much, but once you need to ostracize, say, 100 people, that's when you start having a fight. And as I said, is one of the biggest recurring themes here, you're going to find bigger opposition or counter-opposition to anyone that you consider to be the greatest threat. The bigger the threat, or by threat I mean the bigger perceived threat. And perception means a great deal. So you'll notice here, we've been focusing not so much on what one side said and how did the other side responded, but how did one side respond to the perception of the opposition. For example, if you look back to the Gemara, or the cases that we did on the Gemara about, say, Minim, the heretics, we didn't read heretical documents. We read, here's how the heretics were presented in the rabbinic literature that were then rejected. When you're talking about excluding people from Judaism or excluding a movement, it doesn't matter what they say. What matters is how you take what they say, either how you interpret it or how you extend it. Maybe if you read through it, is it really that bad? Maybe, maybe not. But if you perceive it as a greater either immediate threat or a greater long-term threat, you're going to be much more wary about it than even if what its stated goals. And that's going to be an important thing that we're going to see in this week and next couple of weeks. Yeah?
There's two ways of reacting to one, like the neighbor of my uncle in Lod, Israel, is a house painter. He will not work on Shabbos. You can pay him triple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? But he'll go to the beach with his family.
Okay.
So he is only not performing, or he's not doing anything against it, as opposed to somebody who would go and eat publicly a ham sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, do they make that kind of a distinction?
In terms of on an individual level or a communal level?
Communal level. You know, all those Jews who don't work on Shabbos, but they don't observe, they ride in the car.
Well, so that's a great point, too. I mean, we kind of touched on that last week. You know, if you assume there's a community of non-observant people, and we'll see that a little bit more, even starting with this, we'll see it starting this week, and we'll see it more in subsequent weeks. It's a great point to consider. Now, what do you do with a group of non-observant Jews versus a movement based on non-observance? Right, and a huge distinction there. Or, if not a movement based on non-observance, a movement that's perceived to be based on non-observance, for lack of a better term.
Secular humanistic Judaism.
Which we're going to start getting to today. Yeah.
Just one thing I missed in what you said. I thought you said that they opposed Sabbateanism.
Yeah.
And they opposed Haskalah as opposed to something else that they didn't oppose so strongly.
Secular learning. And we'll see that in a bit. Meaning it wasn't a clear-cut opposition of you're not allowed to know anything that isn't necessarily Jewish, but there were some elements of what would be called or categorized under this umbrella Haskalah movement, right? Which kind of gets back to what George was saying. Is there a difference between a certain action or a certain type of association that would make the biggest distinction? All right, and we're going to start seeing that a little bit more, you know, now in the subsequent generation. So, yeah.
By the way, I'm getting emails from groups that are concerned that Obama's trying to use the FCC to close down talk radio and Hannity. He perceives them as a threat, and I don't blame him because...
Well, I can tell you this. Utopia is a podcast that, you know, I do it in my own pocket. Not that much. We're not going to get shut down that quickly. Yeah, and then we'll go on.
During that period of time, I think it's generally classified as the Age of Reason, where you have Voltaire, Descartes, and others. So, you know, could they, you know, obviously these rabbis are intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't they have any kind of intercourse with that larger philosophical body at that period of time?
It's an interesting point to what they did or what they didn't.
I mean, that would have had to influence them either one way or another.
Yes and no. Honestly, I don't know what they knew and what they didn't know. People who are better scholars in this area could have that guess. From what Fritziger was saying, at least one of the responses wasn't based on a primary reading as much as how it was reported. And when you report it, or even if you read it, you can say, oh, this is what someone said. I included here a very brief summary also from Wikipedia on Moses Mendelssohn, whom I admit is on my shelf, but has been pushed off on the to-do list because I've been practicing the Megillah for Purim, unfortunately. But it is, you know, high on my list of things to read. And we'll go through, I mean, you could skim through this on your own a bit about how Kant and certain things that he stood for. But some of the citations that we have here address how people responded to Mendelssohn. And again, the point here isn't what did Mendelssohn say or what didn't he say. What was the perception of what he said, and what were the perceived ramifications of his ideas? All right. I know that my father had an argument with, there was a particular rabbi that my father once heard that called Mendelssohn an apikores. And my father said, can you back that up, and actually challenge him on it? And the guy couldn't. He was just relying on what everyone else said. Because the person who made the statement, I would guess, never actually read Mendelssohn inside. And I don't think, even if he did, knowing the person who made the statement would probably not think about it that critically and carefully to know whether or not he really went against Jewish law. He was just parroting what everyone else said. So I would recommend, you know, people pick up the main work that people read of him is Jerusalem. Pick it up, read it. There's a whole lot of secondary literature on it that's
Jerusalem
outside of this. Yeah, Moses Mendelssohn. I think the reference is in the part of the citation I have here. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so these are texts and contexts. I included just the one paragraph of introduction from Fritziger, and everything that is indented here are his direct translations of various responsa that I was not able to procure at the Hebrew translation of. Ed, start us off on page 2 with source number 3.
Landor.
Landor meaning the Noda Yehuda, is the first person.
Then made it clear that secular learning, especially attaining a full command of the German language, was in its and of itself a positive thing. But not if it led to exposure to books that contain rationalistic interpretations of the Torah. Thus, the atmosphere in Prague at that time was filled with danger and demanded that loyal Jews remain apart from those who promote such approaches.
Right. So this next paragraph is the quote from his own responsa.
Do not mix with those who are strange or unstable, Shonim, with those who follow arbitrary whims, who cogitate and ponder with their confused intellects, darkening the religion of the Torah, whether they be Jews or from any other people, those who deny individual providence over the affairs of men, who deny the revelation of the Torah and supernatural miracles, who say that religion was not given by the Creator. With them, do not mix. Now, because of our many sins, strange sects have multiplied among our people, each different from the other, except in their common proclivity to undermine the perfect faith. It was about such sects that Solomon warned, do not mix with the strange, unstable, for disaster comes from them suddenly, the doom of them both who can foreknow. He was alluding to those sects that are equal in their in their capacity for evil. There's two in theirs there. One of them is wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we, God's people, are obligated to sacrifice our lives for our sacred Torah, says he, both the written Torah and the oral one. And if those sects mock us, we do not take heed, for we shall walk in the name of God.
Yeah. Any thoughts on this so far?
He's given my life away pretty cheaply, you know, like he has a lot of chutzpah.
All right.
A question and a thought.
Sure.
What's Furtziger?
He is the author of this book. The bibliography is on the last page. These citations are from his book. I figured it was easier just to go through his English translations than to go back and forth with various Hebrew things, especially where I couldn't access the Hebrew.
Okay. And he's not advocating exclusion. He's just saying, he's not saying these people aren't, well, he sort of is, but he doesn't specifically say they're excluded or they should be excluded. He's just saying stay away from them.
I would disagree. And I think Furtziger, when I put in the brackets, is exactly as Furtziger wrote it. Typos are mine. Everything else I tried to copy exactly as possible.
You're forgiven.
Thank you. The language is shonim. The word shonim, right, as he puts in here, strange or unstable, also means different.
Yeah.
When you are different, that means you're not one of us. You are, or at least different enough to say, you are outside the Parsha. And I think he included that Hebrew term. I mean, when people will put in translations, they will include certain Hebrew terms that would be key. You know, almost the Nevin Yavin part of these. But and Shonim, I think, is a very core word here to include, because you're saying these people are completely, you know, they're beyond the pale. And his risk, I mean, as, again, I only feel free to read the entire book where he actually goes through a bit of the intellectual environment of Prague at the time, but this was a concern that he had, that people were being attracted to this mode of thinking that, we'll hold off on that for a second. Dana, read the source number 4. As he explained a little bit further in 4, he's basing his statements of Mendelssohn not on what he actually read, but as was reported to him. So please read source number 4.
Mendelssohn had confirmed the suspicion already raised against him that he opposed coercion as a viable means for ensuring Jews continue to follow Jewish law. Langau considered this to be a rejection of the obligatory nature of a halakha for every Jew. Regarding Mendelssohn, Langau recommended, "Now I see that our entire negative judgment of that man, Otsamaich Mendelssohn, is all true. For he himself has proclaimed that he has no part in the God of Israel nor his Torah, and he has abandoned the path. Rather, he says, all should act as their hearts tells him. For he is a sectarian, if two proper witnesses were to testify that he truly published these types of statements, certainly he too and those among the congregation of Israel who cling to him shall be separated from the congregation of Israel. Anyone whose honor is dear to them must separate from them and not go near them, for God will burn the thorns of his vineyard and defeat the ruthless ones."
Yeah.
Oto ha'ish.
So let's break down this. Let's break down this in a couple of things for a good pickup there. So one, the problem with Mendelssohn here isn't that he's rejecting halacha as much as the very fact that he doesn't that he opposes coercion to force people to forcing people to observe Jewish law is itself a problem.
This is Landau's interpretation.
Or at least that idea. He calls him Oto Ha'ish, right? Evoking.
Jesus.
Yeah. It's used, basically, it's a pretty big insult, which I actually saw used recently, where a colleague referred to someone as Oto HaRabbi, or Oso HaRabbi, as he put it, which doesn't matter what the context is, but yes. And referring to Mendelssohn. So that should also give, it drives the point home that he's not one of us. He actually calls him a min, a sectarian. And he says they shall be separated from the congregation of Israel. So, you know, even if you want to, you know, take a step back from, you know, even if you want to say the source that we just saw above, that, you know, General Musculum, you know, maybe they're not real suited. This is explicit here. He's saying that they're beyond the pale. Yeah.
Can you remind us what exactly in the Talmud was the prescribed treatment for the minion?
There wasn't so much a prescribed, well, according to Rambam, he loses his share in the world to come. I don't recall if there was a set punishment there, if there was a min X, Y, or Z, but there was a sense of they're excluded. I'm trying to remember the details. Are there things that we did to not look like that we were minim? But I don't recall anything of specific punishment of that if someone is a min, here's what we do to them, because we saw there was a wide range of what counted as a min. Mm-hmm. And we did not have a clear-cut definition of a min as someone who does X, Y, or Z. But at least in this context, it means you're no longer Jewish. And he's evoking the Talmudic term to say you are not part of the correct tradition. Now, question, why is all this so bad? Or what are the things that he's really focusing on?
Well, how about if the thing in number three is true,
yeah,
he's basically saying do your own thing.
What do you mean do your own thing?
Each man should follow his own path. No?
That's not a good thing.
No, I'm saying that right. And isn't that one of the things that Landau is objecting to?
With those who follow arbitrary...
All should act as their hearts tells him.
Okay.
No?
Act as... all right. So there... Okay. Now... The allegation then would be, you know, those who follow arbitrary rims, cogitate and ponder in confused intellects and the like. Trying to think, those who deny the Torah, with them do not mix. Where do you see, I'm sorry, I'm missing the quote there.
Third line of number four.
Right.
All should act as their tells them.
Okay.
Tells them.
Okay, rather he should act. Now, here's the question. One, was this in fact what was necessarily advocated? And two, is there any evidence that he cites that people were actually doing things?
Well, I'm not sure how he got to this conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
But now I see that our entire negative judgment of that man is all true. So presumably he got some documentation.
Well, that's again, you're right. He's basing it off of, you know, a report. Primarily, the objections here aren't that people aren't being observant, but rather they're theological problems at the core. Say in source number three, it's that you are denying the revelation of the Torah and miracles and saying that the religion wasn't given by the Creator. Like for any other rational means, that in of itself is a theological problem. In number four, even if you take it at face value that he's reacting against coercion, he can say that as well. If you're not going to force people to do it, then you're giving tacit approval that people can just do whatever they want. And that it's not so much that people were saying you don't have to do mitzvot, but even advocating an idea that would lead people to not have to do mitzvot is what put you aside. And in fact, would be worse than someone who just doesn't do mitzvot. In a way, it would be like under the category of Rambam of Machtia Tarabim. I don't know if they use that phrase, but idiomatically I think would fit. You may not be actually sinning, but you could be causing people to sin. If you take the Torah rationally and you start saying things like, well, God didn't actually give the Torah, or these miracles didn't happen, you don't have to take the Torah literally. Again, here's the theoretical argument. Keep in mind that we're talking about the 1700s. And, you know, today we've had a few hundred years to deal with these issues and to come up with our own, you know, apologetics and our own way of smoothing things over and make our own compromises. Then this was a radical idea, and it could have just been an either or. If you've been taught, you keep the Torah because God told you to keep the Torah, and then you start thinking, well, maybe God didn't give the Torah, or maybe it's not literal, then you start asking questions, well, what else in the Torah isn't literal, in which case, why do I have to keep the mitzvot? Because if the entire religion is predicated on doing what God tells you to do, once you remove that assumption that God tells you to do something, then why are you doing this anymore?
The rabbi loses all his business.
Well, the entire religion falls apart. So theologically, today, we've had a lot more, you know, time to come to terms with such arguments, and, you know, people have managed to smooth things over on their own. But at the time, this was, you know, completely radical and can easily be seen as threatening. And if someone is going to say, don't force people to do mitzvot, right? Not to say, not even saying that, you know, you should encourage people not to do mitzvot. You could say that, well, if you're not going to try to get people to do better, then you're accepting them for who they are. Like, you're what's a good way of putting it? You're sort of giving up on allowing people to do whatever it is that they wish.
Where's as opposed the word to force or coercion in there that you're picking up?
That is from Mendelssohn's. That is from Fritzinger's description here. The suspicion raised against it that the coercion is a viable means.
Yeah.
So basing it off of that. Still, one second. The way it could be perceived is that you're giving tacit approval. Even though on an individual level, he himself might have been understanding of individuals who were not observant, once you set this up as a modus operandi on a global level, then you can see, well, if you're not going to force me, then I could still do what I want and everything's going to be okay, which means you could perceive that to be as encouraging religious unobservance, as opposed to, well, you might not be keeping it, but, you know, we're still going to say you're wrong and still, you know, treat you differently, rather than institutionalizing it. Again, whether or not this is what Mendelssohn advocated is irrelevant. What matters is this is how it appears to have been perceived, and that's why it meant to be excluded. Yeah, and then yeah.
First, a minor question.
Yeah.
Do you think he's quoting from Shoftim, you know, Kol Ishei Asher B'Livo Yaseh? As a way of
characterizing. I took out some of the, I don't recall offhand. I know that for the last one about burning the thorns of the vineyard was something that we saw regarding the Moser, regarding the informer. It was the verse that we saw about, you know, where he said, like, you shouldn't inform on the people, like, I'm just clearing out the thorns, and then someone says, God's going to do that for you. So I don't know if, you know, that was intentional evoking every single...
The other question reference. Is, do you think that he's saying, well, if you follow Mendelssohn's reasoning, then you end up here, do you think that's... Do you see it as a logical chain of reasoning, or do you see it as a false dichotomy that there's only two groups of people in the world, and if you don't believe as we do, then you must be lumped with the father rapers and the mother rapers? And
sitting on the Group W bench.
Exactly.
Love that. Alice's restaurant. The things that your rabbi needs to teach you.
Right.
I don't know, and I don't know for two reasons. One, I'd have to spend a lot more time studying Mendelssohn. In order to say, like, you know, what exactly was there. Two, I don't know the reality of what was around there. Meaning, even if Mendelssohn himself didn't intend it that way, if other people read him that way, that could have been what Landau was reacting to. So, you know, there's, again, were I a better scholar in this area, and even if I wasn't a better scholar, you're dealing with recordings, and you're dealing with, you know, people who are, you know, writing, you know, what possibly is a flawed history, unless you have actual records of here's what people were doing. And even if you have the records, if a rabbi has a sense that people are actively being misled, even if a statement alone might be seen as innocuous, if it's taken in a certain way and you see how people are reacting to it, you might overreact to sort of prevent people from going further. So one is Mendelssohn, another is how are people reacting to Mendelssohn that he could have been reacting to. So was it a logical leap? Maybe, maybe not. Even if it wouldn't be a logical leap from Mendelssohn himself, it could have been a logical leap from what people were doing on the ground that we might not have records of, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
All right. You had a question too? Yeah.
I might be paraphrasing, but I thought you said a moment ago that this isn't so much a matter of observance as theology.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or at least here. I mean, his opposition seems to be rooted in the theology. He's not arguing that the people aren't doing mitzvot.
Yeah.
He's arguing that there's a bad theology that could lead to something worse.
So hang on. So supposing somebody had a consultation with Mendelssohn,
mm-hmm.
and the end result was, forget what you believe, put on tefillin anyway.
Mm-hmm.
If your motivation is, you know, Jesus would have wanted you to put on tefillin, then do it. That's probably, well, put it this way, is that good, bad, or otherwise?
Depending on, so that could depend on your perspective. Something with Zacharia Frankel, for example, who's considered to be the intellectual founder of conservative Judaism. Was attributed of saying things of, we do mitzvot not because they're commandments, but because they're part of, you know, Jewish culture, Jewish heritage. You know, later adapted by Mordechai, a bit by Solomon Schechter in Catholic Israel, Mordechai Kaplan, Judaism and Civilization in various forms. You know, again, people are saying we'll find nuances between them.
There's a book called Catholic Israel.
It's a concept.
An expression.
Yeah, that about it's a fancy, I guess it's a Protestant way of saying the ganze Welt,
the community of Israel.
There you go. Yeah, that's the best way I can describe it.
Okay.
So you could argue, you know, that on one hand you're telling people, you know, these aren't really mitzvot. On the other hand, you're getting them to keep mitzvot. So if you go back to Zacharia Frankel, you can say, well, either he was a reformer in a certain sense, or you could say he was doing kiruv. He was just getting people to do mitzvot, but giving them a rational reason to do mitzvot. And a lot of that's going to depend on your perspective of, is it better to have people do the right thing for the wrong reason, or is by encouraging people to do the right thing for the wrong reason just leading to people doing more wrong things?
So how far do you take mitzvah lishma balishma?
Almost. And don't forget, if you really perceive a threat to your religion, you're going to be a little bit less tolerant. If you look at, say, you know, Chabad, in their kiruv efforts, overlooks a great deal to get people to do mitzvot, because it's in their mind that, you know, people need to do as many mitzvot as possible. One image that, you know, sticks with me for a while, when I was in Chicago, the Chabad rabbi, you know, there's had a guy who ran, he was a dispatch for a trucking company or something like that, or tow truck place, came by on Sukkot, on actual Yom Tov, came in, shook lulav and etrog, and left. And the Chabad rabbi's take was, he just did one more mitzvah than he otherwise would have. And for him, that was a win. It wasn't like a tacit acceptance of it, but, you know, you could say, well, either one, it's not institutionalized, and, you know, it's on an individual level. In this case, you're not, you know, giving tesper, you're just saying, well, it's one more mitzvah that otherwise would have been done. And that's their strategy. And, you know, people become observant through Chabad. All right, now, compare that to, say, the other side. You could say it was strategic, but today, you know, we don't have a big of a threat or perceived threat to the endurance and sustainability of Judaism in general as you did back then. Don't forget, even, you know, not too long ago from now, Max Weber, in his secularization theory, actually posited that as modernity progresses, religion will have a linear decline. And people really thought that even relatively recently. I mean, it's since been disproved because religion still exists. But you can definitely see back in the 1700s, with all these newfangled ideas, the world is beginning to change ever so rapidly. In ways that you couldn't have even imagined and predicted, why people might want to start, you know, putting the brakes on anything. And even though Judaism had evolved and developed over centuries, if it's too much too quickly and you don't have enough control over it, why, you could just fly off the handle and be less tolerant of ideas that might theoretically be okay and might have even been accepted a few hundred years earlier. I hope that answers the question. You know, and it's easy today to pass judgment on, you know, they were being overly intolerant, but you're not in their position, and you don't see what they saw. You know, hindsight, you know, being 2020, you know, maybe they were right. Had it gone the other way, maybe you would have had a very different religion today, because, you know, who knows? There's a lot of speculation there. The point of this is more to show, is, you know, to bring some of those issues to light and to see exactly how they responded, and to try to, you know, get some sense of context of why people might get so extreme.
Our environment and what we were immersed in terms of philosophy, technology, is constantly evolving, changing. There's never been a time when it's been static. And it's coming to a confrontation to these changes that there's reaction. For example, what do we do with e-readers? They're going to start publishing the comic?
Yes, I mean, today we're a little bit more used to the fast-pacing change of technology. You go back to the Industrial Revolution, the entire world was completely changing ways that had never been seen before. Even, like, look at America, the past 100 years, you know, just how much has changed. Today we're, I think, a lot more used to the fast pace, but when you're, I mean, and all, look, change has always happened, but when so much happens so quickly in an unprecedented rate that you've just never been used to,
it's unprecedented only in terms of the concept of delivery. For example, the notion of sending letters. This is revolutionary.
Fine, but
that ships can go between, and this causes people to react to those kinds of changes.
But that doesn't contradict the point at all. I mean, at least the changes back then. Anyway, well, let's move on. Dem takes source number 5. You pass that down. Nice little shift here. So we're talking now about some sources from Rav Yaakov Emden. So different person involved here, contemporary.
In an early response, Emden had differentiated between the study of philosophy, higayon, and natural sciences, chokhmat ha-teva. At the end of an intricate halachic discussion of why he could not permit a Jewish medical student to observe surgery on the Sabbath, he added some personal reflections regarding the entrance of this young man into the world of non-Jewish knowledge and culture. Despite his something for the religious stability of his correspondence,
regard, something like that.
He recognized the importance of medical study. I would say, despite his concern.
Yeah. You know what? Let's just. I'll look it up. I keep telling you people I can't. I need a Dragon software thing.
854.
One second. Yeah. Despite his fears for the religious stability, is the quote.
How could you miss words? Do you use a copying machine?
No, I just type straight through.
Oh, it's your typing.
That's, yes,
sure.
My typing. Yeah.
Okay.
If I could copy and paste, that would be easier.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you that, Dragon.
Well, talk about that later.
Right. Okay. However, regarding the study of philosophy, he said, these wisdoms should be seen by Edomite, i.e. Christian, and Ishmaelite, i.e. Muslim, scholars, and those of the rest of the nations, for they have no other wisdom. For even if one should not be completely naked of such knowledge, in these degenerate times, when each day the stumbling blocks mount and the true light is darkened by that of rational thought, Sechel HaBarur, one should learn only that needed in order to defend against dangerous tongues, so that there should be no room for the attacks of the heretics. Of course.
So he's trying to walk a fine line here about what parts of secular knowledge are okay, but there are certain parts of rational thought which he clearly felt were, you know, threatening. And in this case, you know, reason, which, don't forget also back then, reason was really antithetical to anything that was religious. There was a lot more opposition to, you know, rational thought. Rational thought was much more against religion than it would, say, be today. Whereas today you've got people who can think rationally who might be religious and, you know, have been able to smooth it over. There was a lot more of an either-or, I would say. George, take number 6.
Yet most disturbing to Emden was that which he always feared about philosophy, its potential to provide justification for abandoning traditional Jewish practice, as was now becoming to fruition before his eyes. Initially, Satan opened for them a small aperture to ridicule the words of the sages, and they mocked the masters of the tradition, angels of God. They cast off the yoke of the oral law upon their shoulders,
after they had uprooted the whole section of the Torah, where it is written, you must not deviate from the verdict that they shall declare unto you, either to the right or to the left. The gap now widened for them. They also cast the written law behind their backs. They take no part in the commandments and deeds. I will mention only a few of the customs of licentious ones, Purim.
Meaning it's like you took off the yoke of the commandments.
At the time when the Jews entered the synagogues for prayer, these people go to the services and theaters, offering their bodies in worship of the impulses to satisfy their lusts. At the time when the Sabbath and festivals begin, when the holy nation is occupied with sanctifying the day, honoring the day with many candles, in their homes and their homes there is darkness. In their homes there is darkness, for they are among the harlots, the latter, in the fishing boats. They waste the most of their time preoccupied with frivolous books, with words of sexual desire, sensual lust, and heresy. Now licentiousness.
New licentiousness that comes forth every day.
New licentiousness that comes forth every day from the printing presses.
All right. Any English majors here? People know stuff that was going on, you know, what was being printed in the late 1700s? Might be able to.
Yeah, fishing boats?
I don't know what was wrong with the fishing boat part, because people had to, fish. But what he saw was in the attraction of the rational world had a great deal, here he's actually talking that the threat of the rational world, or, philosophers, would actually lead people away from Judaism. And, they weren't keeping Shabbos. They were actually getting fully involved in the more libertine culture of the age, for lack of a better term.
But is that his view?
Yeah.
I mean, not necessarily people sleeping all over. But that is a way of separating that, putting them out further. I say that, they do all these terrible things.
Well, so you can either say, look at the people who are doing these terrible things, and therefore they've demonstrated that they're out, or you can say, well, this is all part of a movement that leads people astray, right? So, look, we've had people who haven't kept Shabbos, for many years, but if you see that this is something that's actually attracting people away, and is starting to bring people away, say, wait, we have to, respond to this accordingly. Yeah.
I just want to know, historically, what was going on. Was this a case where the bottle was uncorked and people were free to move more in secular society, so they absorbed those things? Or was this a case of somebody forming the Reform religion? Is Zacharia Franco at
Not time? Yet. Not yet. Yeah. This is just, people who are starting to get swayed by rationalism. People sort of predicting that this was going to be a threat and to try to, be part of that world.
But this is nothing new. Because this circuses and theaters, Kipuzim and Teatronim, is in Rashi about why people died in Malchus Choshech.
Did people go? Right. But he's saying here exactly. Here specifically, it's one thing to embrace secular culture; it's another thing to do so at the expense of the religion.
Well. Even if when it wasn't at the expense of religion, that's a reason given.
On a medieval level. I mean, Rashi's take on it. Whether or not they had, circuses in Egypt, I don't know. Maybe a little, whatever.
Rabbi Benden is not exactly Mr. Happy Fun Guy.
Well, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. source number 7 here.
The philosophers of the 1770s were not just heterodox in their rationalistic outlook. Their combination of deviant ideology with deep had placed them beyond the margin. They are surely not of the seed of Israel, only descendants of the mixed multitude, Arab. We are not responsible nor guarantors for them, although Jews are responsible for one another. Nevertheless, one must be careful to separate oneself from them and their murmurings so that the holy and pure seed of Israel not stumble through them. We should not have any business dealings with them, and they should not come for burial in Jewish graves. I hope that their neighbors are not smitten by their ways. Just one obligation exists for us, to save our brothers, the pure, the legitimate, and upstanding children of Israel, that they may separate from them the philosophers. They shall not live among them, lest they be scorched by their flaming cults.
Now keep in mind, this is from someone who actually embraced secular knowledge. Right? He did not reject it entirely, but there was a certain mode of philosophy that was a clear challenge to the Jewish faith that had practically, at least based on his testimony, had already succeeded in bringing people away from the Jewish faith. So you could see him like trying to tighten the screws to say, easiest thing to do is to just not get involved at all. Right? Now, you could say strategically, you know, if you have a competing ideology, and we, you know, have the benefit from speaking about this in 2011, you can say, well, we can try arguing with them, right? But it's hard to argue, you know, with rationalists. I mean, to really have like a full debate about it, you're not talking about Christianity versus Judaism. You're talking about, let's say, atheism or some form of rationalism versus Judaism, and it's a very different sort of argument. Because you're not even playing with the same modes of discourse. And one of my favorite passages, John Stuart Mill argues, it's in this introduction of On the Subjection of Women. And he says that basically treating women on as a different level of men is irrational, but you can't argue that rationally with people who are discriminating. Because if someone's arguing based on reason, you can argue with an irrational position, because it means you have to prove why you're right, which is fine. They also have to prove why they're wrong. They don't have to prove why they're right. And even if you prove why you're right and they're wrong, they can still stick to their rational belief as saying, ah, this is just how great my belief is because I'm going to believe this even in the face of all of your arguments. And
even though it makes no sense.
Or not even though it makes no sense, it's because it makes no sense. It shows just how faithful you are.
Right.
You know, it's a really wonderful passage there. But you can see why if you're, you know, if this is out of control, you're not going, and this is part of the culture around you, I mean, you're no longer talking about, say, a church entity that's threatening. This is everyone, right? This is like you go out in the street and this is what people are talking. It's so much more prevalent, right? You can't just say, well, we're going to have a debate with, you know, pop culture, but rather it'll be easier and, you know, perhaps strategically it makes more sense to withdraw entirely, because that's something that you can do. And he's not even saying doing it entirely, because again, he's still held of it, but you start seeing some of the ideas of, well, we're going to withdraw, that this outside world is posing too much of a threat to Judaism as we see it.
Circle the wagons.
Yes. Circle the wagons, withdraw a little bit more, because they're tempting people away from Judaism. We can't have that. Didn't feel that we could fight them. Maybe they didn't want to fight them, because don't forget, the Vilna Gaon didn't want to fight the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, because you don't want to give credence to it. You have the risk you might lose. There are a whole lot of reasons why you don't want to take it on, why you don't want to address it. You also might not want to, you know, give in any little point. My father got from one of his professors, who was a Bible critic, you know, about, you know, trying to rationalize or describe some of the verses, or harmonize some difficult verses, you know, from biblical criticism with a traditional approach. And the professor said something like, you can't be half pregnant. It's like, once you make a certain concession, you know, you haven't really gained all that much. And they could have seen it as just a really big risk. And this is assuming they have the capacity to argue on their terms. I mean, don't forget, you know, philosophy is a very distinct field that has a certain mode of discourse. And if you try to enter a philosophical discourse unprepared without knowing the terminology and the precision of language, you're going to be pretty embarrassed at the end, and you know, people can wipe the floor with you and you wouldn't necessarily know it. So at any rate, you know, I put this as sort of a precursor. You see, I mean, you could already see anticipating how things can get more extreme. That even in the late 1700s, you saw, or at least, you know, two individuals, you know, the Nota Yehuda and Rav Yaakov Emden, saw this as a threat of the philosophers. Whether or not they actually were in opposition to halakha doesn't matter. I mean, again, we have hindsight of several hundred years of trying to work this stuff out. But for them, one, you were dealing with a different culture when it was either or. Two, rationality was more in direct opposition to religion. And three, they saw this as a legitimate threat to the future of Jewish practice.
What's the word? It's not jingoistic. There's something about being afraid of outsiders.
Xenophobic.
I see them as xenophobic.
Well, for that, if the outsiders are actually going to threaten the religion, then sure. I mean, if you lived among, say, Muslims, or you lived among Christians, which we've done, everyone there believes in a god or some religion of some sort. You're operating within a religious framework, so they're not going to threaten you as much because you're all operating religiously, just differently. And you did have people that went, one place to another, but you did not have such a concerted threat to the viability of Judaism because the world was a little bit more similar. They still thought religiously. Here, people are thinking on a completely different wavelength. So you're not just talking about Judaism versus an opposing belief, an opposing religious belief. You're talking about Judaism versus an alternative way of thinking and a way of living that kind of would make religion obsolete, at least as some people would advocate in secularization theory. Because if you would view religion as a way of answering the questions of the world, well, you now have a bunch of other ways of answering the questions of the world that might make a whole lot more sense. It's observable, right? Why does the sun rise? Why does the sun go down? How does the world work? Science and physics, right? All of these fields, science, physics, and math, answer questions that were previously attributed to gods. Like, it rains because, in the right time, because God's happy with you. You have, harsh weather because God's mad at you. Okay.
Can the sun ever stand still?
That was, people, we don't really have, regular recordings for that, but like, clip stuff like that. You think, oh, there's some divine significance behind it. Once you can explain that through rational means, the religious, spiritual, or whatever type of mythos you attribute to natural events, it's like, wait, why am I believing in this? I've got a better answer, right? These are arguments that, people have, talked about for, many years, but you can see, like, the beginnings of it, why, someone could be easily attracted to it. Because if the whole reason why you do certain things is so that God doesn't get angry with you, or God, let's even take the shmaf, the whole reason why you do mitzvot is so that God gives you rain in the right time, well, once you know how rain works, then you no longer need to do mitzvot.
But
if you take the assumption of, Vayam Shamar, if you do what's right, God will bring you the rain and the time, and if you don't, God's going to destroy you. But now you know how rain works. You know about, the precipitation cycles. You know about the environment. Then you know it's not God who's bringing it. It's part of the natural world, and you can adjust accordingly.
And you can't... The average Jew who learns about the precipitation cycles might very well associate, well, God invented the precipitation cycles and is perpetuating.
Today, not in the 1700s. Again, you're thinking like like some of the college education today. And it's a very different worldview. Back then, people were not accustomed to the nuance, and it was basically an either-or. In a sense, it is nuance. Because we've had several hundred years to develop these ideas, and some people still reject it entirely. Look, you still have, groups of Jews who say, don't go to college because you learn heresy. You've got places that won't teach you math, right, or anything secular at all. Or anything, or science. Well, even though you need to know some degrees of science to know halakha, give an example, to know shechita, right, the laws of shechita and trefo, you need to know the biology of an animal. Right, so you know what the simanim are, and what the deal is there. Not even entrance, like anything secular, bad. And there are schools today, I would guess in America, but certainly in Israel, where they do that. So it's not so far-fetched that people would just see things in absolutes, especially if you've never been used to it. Yeah. Especially if you've never been used to, not seeing things in absolutes. Sorry, just want to clarify. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that there's this new phenomenon called science and reason, which is a challenge to religion. But wasn't there always a science and a reason? It's just it was Aristotle instead of Newton. Or I don't know the name.
It was the Rambam.
Archimedes.
And people burnt the Rambam for relying on philosophy. You know, and there are people who deny that, oh, Rambam either really didn't mean it or Rambam. People, you know, would actually try to write apologetics for the Rambam in terms of writing philosophy. Right? But, yeah.
So there was always this alternative. I mean, the Greeks had their own explanation.
Not to the same extent, because culturally people were still religious, or at least pop culture was still religious, or there was still some religious element behind it.
Before the invention of the printing press, most of the Jews in the shtetl didn't know about Aristotle.
Well, that too. I mean, and that's actually a good point here. One of the sources here actually mentioned the dissemination of the printing press, which means if one person came up with a wacky idea, it used to be just limited to one group. Now, everyone can read it. Think of it today as a blog, for lack of a better term. Anyone can just write a blog and say ridiculous stuff online, and 90% do. You know, so you could disseminate all these crazy ideas, which is, you know, should be some consideration why people like take to banning the internet, because there's a lot of crazy stuff on there. You know, and the easiest way of, I mean, it's easy to say, well, instead of actually like teaching you, you know, how to respond and how to integrate, it's a lot much more practical to, you know, start censoring. But what's in, again, just to, you know, recap here, both Rav Yaakov Emden and the Noda B'Yehuda did not eliminate all secular knowledge, right? And they did see some value to it. It just, they were, you know, sort of walking this line that later generations won't even be able to follow this nuance, and to try to say, well, where is exactly that boundary line of this is okay learning and this is not okay learning, or even associations of types of people, because who are the ones who are going to be able to teach you the secular learning if not people who have studied secular learning? You know, and keep that as an open question, but at least you can see that the tension exists, which means they were not absolute. What's a good word for it? They were not absolute. My mind's failing today. Someone help me with the word. They were a rejectionist would be a good word. They did not were not absolute rejectionists of the entire secular world. Yeah, and then, yeah.
That being barred, especially since I just heard the lecture by Dina.
Yeah.
He says that he recognizes about a Jewish medical school who can observe surgery.
Yeah.
But he objects to it on Shabbat. So even the reason for allowing that medical knowledge to be gained by a Jew was so that he could save life.
Mm-hmm.
If he were to gain that knowledge on Shabbos, that would be prohibited.
A separate question at the time, it could just be going to school, unless we actually read the truth inside, which we're not going to do. I don't want to argue too much on that specific point. So we'd have to see his argument.
Okay, this is a speculation question.
Sure.
Would the Noda B'Yehuda and Rav Yaakov Emden approve of YU?
Today, I don't know. I mean, some people would like to say that they would. You could argue YU today could be YU in the 1700s, maybe not. I mean, also when you
What's the maybe not?
Well, because they could say any sort of compromise or any sort of integration would have been a threat to the Jews in that era. When YU comes up and you've actually, I mean, people worked hard to try to smooth things over and to try to say, yes, they're really, you really don't have to make that choice today. And I think, you know, it's a trick. And again, you can, some have said, well, you're either not fully religious or you're not fully scientific and you really have neither. But an attempt, the attempt has been made, and I think more successful than not. All right?
Yeah.
Oh, excellent. So, and here, anyone interested, our Tuesday night class will be Rav Meir and Elisha Ben Avuya, Tuesday night at 7:30, and next week we'll continue with some of the good stuff here. Have a wonderful week.